All right, so we're going to get started. My name is Aaron Moulton. I'm the Senior Curator of Contemporary Art here at the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. And it's our pleasure to introduce you guys to Triple Candy. They've curated the exhibition next door. I'm just going to give a little introduction from my own experience with them, and then I'll give a bit of their own biography. So I first established a kind of professional contact with Triple Candy, who is Peter Nesbitt and Shelley Bancroft here, sometime in 2006. The first contact, which we realized was a complaint that I got. When I was editor at Flash Art, we commissioned people to write reviews about exhibitions, and I'm based in Milan, and so I'm just farming these things out to different people around the globe, and of course I don't see these shows, and I just get these texts and these images, and you know, and we print them. And so I got a sort of, you know, angry email from Peter saying that whoever wrote the review of our show had clearly never seen it. And it was the first time I had received a complaint of this kind, and I really realized, wow, how little I know about my writers and what they're up to. But it was the first conversation I think we started to have about misrepresentation things are depicted through other people's interpretation, and so it was a kind of a nice beginning. Later, in the spring of 2006, they made an exhibition called The Unauthorized Retrospective of David Hammons, which we'll talk about at length here, and that was an exhibition that I think really was something that changed a lot of perceptions about what an exhibition could be, and for an artist who had made a quite an intensive effort to prevent an exhibition of that kind happening. We'll talk a bit about David and that part of his personality here in a second. And then that exhibition was then followed by an exhibition called Katie Noland Approximately, which we will touch on here as well. And in that case, they took their exhibition practice even further. I'm being vague because we're going to get into the details here. But anyways, their exhibition making process is very different, and yet something we're ultimately very familiar with. But in terms of the art experience, it's a very different approach to exhibition making and how the art experience is mediated. So we did an interview in Flash Art, which helped kind of decipher a bit of their approach and issues of institutional license and how they take control of an artist's career and their depictions that they do in their exhibitions. And for me, they've been an incredible influence in how I personally approach curatorial practice, and they've been incredibly liberating in how one can think about possibilities. I think there's a lot of restrictions in place and a lot of parameters that we just kind of go with in terms of convention and needing to acquire these original objects from the source with the artist, etc. And I think they cleared that path to make it a little bit easier in some cases. And at the same time bringing up a lot of questions about permission and authenticity and authority and responsibility as it relates to how an institution can do what it does. And I think in that respect, they're very much about the mutation leading to an evolution of sorts and how we think about exhibition making and the role of institutions. The exhibition next door, I hope you all will have a chance to see it after this talk. We're going to start the talk doing a survey of their practice and then focus in on the exhibition that you'll see in our new genres gallery, which is called Of the Siren in the Sky, which is a retrospective of the artist Siren Bliss, also known as Sky Jones, also known as Michael Whipple. And it's a rabbit hole, very much a rabbit hole that you could get lost in, trying to understand the very layered world that this person has created, almost an infrastructure that one could then say is a parallel art world. And in that respect, you know, if we can zoom back, and it becomes an interesting metaphor to how one can understand the art world and its various processes of infrastructure, integrity, authority, production, consumption. And And so for their bio, Triple Candy is an alternative space that opened, that operated two street-level galleries in Harlem between 2001 and 2010. In its early years, it presented the work of emerging and established artists such as Polly Apfelbaum, Sanford Biggers, Charles Gaines, Robert Gober, Jim Hodges, Shaniqui Smith, among others. And then in 2006, Triple Candy stopped working with artists and began curating exhibitions about art, but devoid of it. It presented more than three dozen exhibitions in this vein, including David Hammond's The Unauthorized Retrospective, Katie Nolan Approximately, Additions in Sculpture, 1984 to 2000, and Maritza Catalan is Dead, Life and Work, 1960 to 2009. Triple Candy is now based in Philadelphia, functioning as a nomadic gallery that produces exhibitions for museums. It is run by Shelley Bancroft and Peter Nesbitt, trained art historians. If we could please welcome Triple Candy. So I guess I want to start off asking some basic questions, such as what does Triple Candy mean? Where's the name come from?
When our first apartment in Harlem, there was a bodega across the street from us called Triple Candy, and that's really basically, it was spelled with a Y. We spell it with an I-E in the end. But we thought it was interesting. We also didn't want to make it our names. I mean, nonprofits traditionally don't do that anyway, but you know, but there's also the idea of triple being great, better than, you know, double. Triple is like a lot more. And candy is something that, you know, is seductive and something we all want.
And how would you say that before you kind of took this departure from conventional exhibition making, how would you say the program at Triple Candy differentiated itself from your typical nonprofit in New York?
Well, I think being in Harlem, we're about 7 miles north of Chelsea, which is, you know, obviously where most of the galleries have been situated in New York for the past more than a decade. So this is Chelsea, and this is where all the galleries are. And then, you know, in the last 10 years, there's been a lot of galleries that are opened on the Lower East Side, which is here, or in Brooklyn, which is over here. And the only organization that there's the Studio Museum in Harlem, which is was started in 1969, and it's a venerable institution, does really great programming. But there's really no galleries. There's really no galleries, not only in Harlem, but there's no galleries north of sort of Midtown, the whole upper half of the island, which is literally half of the island. It's an enormous swath of land. So we first, I think, distinguished ourselves or sort of deliberately positioned ourselves by not being where the other galleries were, to be, by being in a neighborhood, in a context, social and otherwise, that didn't, you know, where we were sort of alone. And so we tried to show really great art in a place that didn't have a lot of galleries.
And I mean, I think the other thing, and I think this is something that Aaron's doing right now too in this museum, is that there's really most of the nonprofit spaces that were downtown were primarily showing emerging artists, and that is kind of in New York, that's where a lot of artists would get their start. But we wanted to, you know, work with emerging artists, but then to couple them with established artists to kind of give the established artists some freshness and some validity to the younger artists. So that was one thing that was really important to us. And then also doing solo shows, which seems kind of silly, but, you know, 10, 12 years ago, nonprofits really weren't doing solo shows. Mm. They were primarily focused on group shows of emerging artists. So those were the things that we were interested in from the get-go.
And at a certain point, we noticed that the nonprofits at the time when we started in 2001 were sort of in a state of crisis. I mean, a lot of them grew up in the early 70s, late 70s, early 80s, and they were trying to provide opportunities for artists that weren't being served by the commercial market. So there were young artists, emerging artists, there were artists, you know, African-American artists or Hispanic artists that got gathered together and started collectives. There was AIR Gallery, which was founded to show the work of women artists. As the market started to absorb and get better about showing many of these artists' work, I think a lot of nonprofits started to become, you know, they sort of were sort of facing their own potential irrelevancy.
And they started looking more and more like the commercial galleries.
Right. So in order to stay relevant, they, rather than differentiating themselves from the mainstream art institution or galleries, they actually tried to look more like them in some ways, to try to regain some relevance. Mm-hmm. And we were very, very, very conscious of that and didn't want to go that. Once we became aware that this was happening, it became really important for us to try to distinguish our program by somehow doing something different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And just a bit about your backgrounds. You're trained art historians. We've gotten to know each other. It's odd. We've sort of known each other for 6 years, and yet we never spoke on the phone or met until Tuesday, which was hilarious because I think once you get a sense of the practice, my suspicion was always that they didn't really exist. And so it was refreshing to finally meet them and in the flesh. But we've gotten to know each other in these days, but I just you come to running a space and how, what you bring to it with your backgrounds. I'm just wondering if there's anything you point out that have been kind of important, influential sort of paths.
In terms of art history?
Or, you ran a magazine that was quite important called Art on Paper.
Right. I mean, I think the magazine influenced the gallery, and the gallery influenced the magazine in terms of editorially, in terms of our desire to want to write and explain and educate people about art. Like, we don't ever want to do it in a pedantic way or we're talking down to somebody, but we really believe in the power of words and that artwork should be explained. You know, there are a lot of people that are like, well, it should just speak for itself, what we put up there. But for us, it's very much about a justification for what we're doing. And I think comes from school, too, I think.
Mm-hmm. We started in the gallery in 2001, and we ended up through a strange string, a sort of sequence of events, owning a internationally distributed art magazine that was basically going bankrupt, that we stepped in and decided that we thought we could write it, and we did. And it was internationally distributed art magazine, so we were assigning reviews and we were assigning feature articles and all of this. And I think one of the things that became very apparent to us immediately was this issue of representation. I mean, you become really aware once you start assigning reviews and going and seeing the shows yourselves and then reading it against the review you received, of the sort of the various decisions that are made on how one represents something. And so many of us receive most of our information about the art world through these channels. Mm. And to some degree, we might be aware that these are particular representations of something, and there might be other representations that exist. But I don't think we certainly weren't sensitized to that as much as we were when we were all of a sudden responsible for that, like Aaron was talking about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think this issue of representation became sort of really critical for us. Like, how do you choose which image is going to represent an entire show of, 100 pieces? That becomes a really critical decision, though it's often made for reasons that aren't necessarily...
Logistical reasons.
Yeah, logistical reasons, the shape of the image or the color of the image that's going to look good on the page.
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
You're making a lot of decisions that... are really having a profound influence on how people around the world are understanding something, and yet the decision-making behind it. So that became really fascinating. But the art historian side of it, too, we should talk about briefly.
What do you mean?
Well, we met in graduate school getting a master's in art history in Seattle, and I think, we were studying contemporary art and theory while all of our colleagues were working with historic material. And most art history is often... And the majority of art historians are working with objects whose creators are deceased and dead. So there's a really sort of arm's length relationship, or much greater, to your subject. And I think to some degree, since we weren't contemporary critics or theorists or writers, I think we brought some of that art historical sort of that framework to bear on what we were doing. And I think when we ultimately, shifted to not working with artists, synced up really well with our sensibilities in that we could pretend that the subjects that we were working with, alive or dead, were dead, mm-hmm. and we would have a responsibility to them as distant subjects, and would have a certain ethical responsibility to represent them in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. And I think the research part of it too comes in there, because otherwise, you know, we wouldn't have that. What are you researching when you're doing a group show of contemporary artists? You know, so
it's a different type of research,
yeah.
form of research, yeah.
Cool. Well, here's an interior view of how the space in Harlem looked. This is actually the exhibition that we reviewed at Flash Art, which we reviewed incorrectly. And then I want to just jump right into the David Hammons exhibition that you guys did. This is an ad that they made for a publication I made. So it was an ad produced some 5 years after the exhibition. It's a very special exhibition because of the person. David Hammons is a conceptual artist whose work is very much about kind of instrumentalizing his African-American background in a conceptual way that leads to kind of producing materials and aesthetic sort of situations that reference ghetto culture or black culture in various forms. Very delicate works, very expensive works. He's a highly sought after artist, and he's also very much a personality in how he allows his art to be seen. He's very much setting up restrictions, and I wonder if we could first talk a bit about David in terms of those parameters that were. Like before your show, I know myself some of these things, but what is the problem with David Hammons?
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a very contradictory figure, because while he is probably one of the most important, you know, African American artists in the country, maybe even the world, he also he takes that, but he also kind of exploits it. And by that I mean, he uses materials that are low materials to make very highly conceptual and provocative pieces, but he won't allow people unless, now this is at a point in his career where he is right now, where he's very successful. He considers himself an artist of the people, but he only shows his work at Blue Chip Artists, and his work sells for, it's very expensive. So there's this weird disconnect between being someone who's representing the people by the materials and the context and the content of his work versus the context in which he shows and where he shows his work. So that, right off the bat, is just this, you know, weird thing. And we've always really loved his work. And his studio is right down the street from our gallery. But we knew even when we got there that there would be no way that he would ever work with us.
In part because we wouldn't fit into his strategy. In part, but it's funny. We did a show with an artist probably about a year or two before this, who worked with his daughter, with David Hammond's daughter, in a performance in our gallery. And David Hammond's came to the performance, and so we had interactions with him. It's not like we didn't know him.
He didn't come all the way in. He just stood though in the
doorway.
And
looked in. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's a very elusive figure. I have a friend who was a longtime editor at publishing house Feiden, which does a big chunk of the art books you find in your bookstore, and one of his projects he was always desperate to get to nail down was to do a big survey catalog on David Hammons. I think there's a real desire to see David Hammons' work. He's a wildly influential person, from his material sensibility to his conceptual approach, and yet there has not been a proper retrospective ever in a museum, as far as I can tell. It's only kind of project-based things. He actually limits the ability for...
To even lend work.
Yeah, so if you buy a work by David Hammons, you are restricted from how and when and to whom you can lend it, I think, based at his discretion. And I think, is there even a condition that just says...
I think certain museums, we've been told that, like, the Harvard Art Museum owns a David Hammons, and they completely restricted from lending it, and they wanted to do a show of a small grouping of David Hammond's works that they would have had to borrow from other sources, and he restricted the lending so that they were forced to actually go out and buy more work in order to show it.
Do a show. That's hilarious.
He's very savvy. He's also very, he's a trickster kind of character who plays a lot with punning titles and
Because of this weird, you know, juxtaposition of these two different types of people, that's kind of how we saw it: someone who's very elusive and somebody but who's so embedded in the art world at the same time,
and successful within it,
who has very strong racial, Afrocentric feelings, and that's part of the reason I think why he didn't want to come into our gallery. I might say that. You know, it was like this kind of love-hate relationship. Like, we love his work, but we had a hard time with his methodology and how the material is just his materialistic.
And he was ultimately unreachable.
Ultimately unreachable. So we thought, well, this is an opportunity for us to talk about subjects that we care about in the art world by using the example of an artist who's right here that,
So maybe we talk about the show.
Okay.
What was the exhibition? This is the unauthorized retrospective. So what did one have?
So if you walked into the gallery with this very large space, you found 100 photocopies, but presented in chronological order, quite heavily researched, because, as Aaron was saying, they didn't all exist in one book. There was no book. There was no retrospective catalog. Chronologically around the room, starting from works from the early to mid-60s all the way to 2004, and the show was in 2006. The way we researched the show was went to the Museum of Modern Art Library. Every single little artist catalog or pamphlet or exhibition brochure review in a newspaper, we photocopied everything we could find. So it was the most exhaustive collection of his work in what, or representations of his work in one place.
Mm-hmm.
And because of this pent-up desire to see the work that he so sort of cagily denied the public, when we opened the show and it was just photocopies, we were surprised, we weren't expecting this, but people came out in droves to see this work because they were so hungry for it. Just any glint of information, and many of the photocopies, because, you know, we're photocopying often like an old newspaper article we're photocopying a photocopy that the Museum of Modern Art had made of something, was really degenerated. So you might have an image of a sculpture, you had a John Henry sculpture that was a rock with hair shavings glued on top of it from barbershops, which by the time it got to our generation was just basically like this big smudge blob on a page. So it kind of underscored that distancing.
But it was also, when this started happening, it became part of the show for us, too, because that was our way to get critical about him. You know, he's elusive and evasive, and we're going to use that same strategy back on his work for his public.
So it was educational but miseducational at the same time.
Right. Was there disappointment? You know, I mean, somebody's expecting the retrospective that they've been waiting for, and how did that play out when, you know, people were just given images of the work rather than the work itself?
Well, we were surprised by, you know, I mean, we were telling Aaron that there was a critic who came in who was expecting the work to be real work, and when he found out that it wasn't, he was very angry and made that very clear to us. And in, I don't think he wrote something. Yes, he did. Well, he wrote us an email. But surprisingly,
people were so happy, I think, just to have whatever information they could get. And this sort of, it, you know, helped them in their own sort of thinking about the work, advanced it, just you know, ever so much more, because they could, for the first time, because everything had been these little piecemeal glimpses, they could see it all laid out. They could start to see a certain progression. They could start to see how certain themes sort of, you know, with any artist's work, sort of cycle back through over time. And it sort of got a sense of the overall structure and arc of a career, no matter, even if it was hard to actually.
But there was also, I would say, and I don't, you know, I don't know, this is an underlying thing, and this is something that Peter and I talk about, but there was a sensitivity to which we approached this. And they were very, I mean, you know, the photocopies, whatever, but they were very carefully considered. And, you know, everything, you know, the tape, everything about them was, we wanted it to have a certain degree of aesthetic interest.
Yeah, it looks very consistent.
And reverence to a certain degree, even if there was these other.
I remember personally feeling it kind of looked like a show that was secretly made by David Hammons.
Right.
And I don't think I was alone in feeling that, even though I only saw the exhibition through images.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering whether that was echoed elsewhere, or you know.
That was echoed, and at first we were, well, that's okay if people want to think that, because people are going to think what they want to think, and we're just more interested in the fact that people are interested in seeing the show. But then after a while, people started actually printing that in the press, and I think we started saying to ourselves, well, wait a minute, you know, this was our idea, and he wasn't involved.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I remember calling Robert Storr and saying to him, you know, I want you to understand this is not, I know it may seem like it, and I think because in part, it was a big deal to us, you know,
yeah.
It was like a kind of a breakthrough moment for us as curators, and I think
we wanted to reclaim it, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We needed to.
But no, yes, you were not alone in that thinking.
We're going to jump now to the next iteration, which was the Katie Noland Approximately. This is, again, an advertisement they gave me. I'm, I think, one of the few people that owns these JPEGs. So I'm honored to show them. And this is a very different exhibition. Katie Noland also deserves a short introduction. She is very much like David Hammons in that she's a very elusive character who's yet been wildly influential in how we consider sculptural practice and also infusing sculpture and art generally with political narrative. But known for using very, like David Hammons as well, very poor materials, things you can easily find at your supermarket or, in this case, liquor store. And she, even more than David Hammons, in terms of this difficulty, these parameters that are set up and how to prevent people from seeing the totality of the practice, Katie Noland is a next level in that. She's, one could say, you know, I don't know what the right politically correct word would be. Yeah, litigious.
Yeah.
And controlling. I know people that have made exhibitions with works by Katie Noland in London, and that she would fly over unannounced for this exhibition and storm into the opening, you know, or declaring that they needed to remove this work. She's also someone who's gone and very much tried to erase herself from existence, in that you're, today the internet makes that very difficult, but the image that we had here is literally the only image of Katie Noland you will find online. I have another one which has been removed, but this is an image taken at Documenta 9 in Kassel in like 1989 or 1992, I can't remember the dates. But Katie Noland I really want to use a specific vocabulary to describe her personality, because she's really a difficult person and made very kind of unstable moves to limit the way in which her work is seen. And even I heard a rumor she had an ad in the back of Art Forum magazine offering to buy Katie Noland sculptures, and that was her trying to buy back her sculptures from collectors to then bring all the stuff back. The most recent rumor that I've heard is Larry Gagosian of Gagosian Gallery was
interested in doing a retrospective, or, you know, Gagosian is a commercial enterprise, but one of the top is the top tier one. And you know, when they want to do that, they just do it. So they go and they buy all the work at auction and from collectors and get it on loans from museums. And they do it without much consultation of the artist, unless there's a good relationship to establish. And so Larry had amassed the work to do it and received a call from Katie Nolan saying that she would kill herself if he did such a thing. And they canceled it.
Wow.
I've heard this from several different sources. And I don't...
I'm glad we didn't know that before.
Yeah. So this then is just kind of almost that much more of an assault on the artist's intent, in a way, to then imagine what it would be like to see that retrospective that you always wanted to see all of the work together, and yet, you know, you'd never be allowed to do it. So it's quite a departure from the Hammonds show, in that the Hammonds was, of course, about this. This lens of mediation, and that they're all kind of consistently seen through the photocopy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in this case, you actually reconstructed and remade the works.
Right. And I think that was the thing that people thought that was the step that went too far. That the Hammonds, people accepted pretty readily. But to actually remake a three-dimensional object seemed to go over the line, because it's too close reality. Like, a picture is just a picture, you know. It's, we know all about reproductions, but an object is a very different thing. Not necessarily to us, it wasn't, but to the public. Just quickly about Katie Nolan, too. Her father was Kenneth Nolan, very famous. I guess he was abstract.
Hard edge.
And so she kind of grew up under that, too. Scrutiny, and she's considered, an unstable person. I mean, clearly that you can, you know, from what Aaron has said, you can sense that. But we knew this about her going into it. We knew that she was difficult. We knew that she was sensitive. And from our perspective, that was a big question. It wasn't a big question, because when do you... And as curators, is that our responsibility to say, well, the mental stability of an artist, is that supposed to be a consideration of whether or not you show their work or not?
Mm-hmm.
How do you weigh,
as an institution, the desires of your public,
mm-hmm.
and even sort of the historical need for clarification and understanding about a subject with a single artist's desire for how their work is received?
Right.
At a certain point, you know, from our perspective, she'd made a decision to be public, showed these works, sold them to museums. They're out in the world. So we felt that, you know, all of a sudden the cat's out of the bag, or the train has left, whatever metaphor you want to use. It's sort of, you can't pull it back. And so you've already have an engagement not only with a public in a specific period of time, but you've got you've started to chart a place historically within, you know, the arts.
Mm-hmm.
And because there was very little documentation of her work too, I mean, there's more than Hammond's, but what we used as our resource to make the work were images off the internet that we could find. So often in times we weren't sure, or we weren't sure what the material was or the scale of the piece, except for this large installation. We had seen that in the collection, the Rubin collection.
Rubel.
So some of the things we knew and we had seen and we understood, and we could try to recreate them as best we could. She actually used, what's interesting about Katie, unlike David, is that, yes, they're readily accessible materials, but they're things that you could buy at the store, you know, from the hardware store. And they're all, you know, the consistent kind of theme is Americana, so it's like flags and Budweiser beer and walkers and stuff like that, tires. But since she made these things 20, 30 years ago, a lot of the elements we couldn't even find anymore.
Like the design of the Budweiser can is totally different in Katie Nolan.
Well, that, yes, but, right, like the, you know, the whitewashed tires,
Oh, yeah.
And to agree, we also had our own self-imposed limitations of very tiny little budget. And so we were going to, it didn't become an attempt to try to exactly and faithfully replicate the work. It became an attempt to sort of approximate the work, which is why the title was Katie Nolan Approximately, so that people could have an approximate feel for what a retrospective of her work might be like.
Mm-hmm. Why didn't she sue you?
You know, there are a couple things that we're really clear about. When money is involved, we're not selling her work. That's the first thing. And the second thing is we're not saying it's her work. Those are the two most important things. When you're upfront and you're clear about the fact that this is not her work, and there's no money, there's no money transactions. And I think that just by that alone, she didn't have a.
It's a harder case for her, I think.
Yeah, I think she probably would have loved to. I mean.
And about these, this change in sentiment with the response to something where you're now creating the physical objects. It's got a whole kind of. But I mean, this show, both of these exhibitions have, I think, a knee-jerk reaction that one would assume is in the realm of parody in a way. That these, and I don't know why, and I'm interested in that. We've been talking a bit about that in these last days. But I guess that's a word that needs to be addressed in this case, because these aren't parodies. I think. And nor is the exhibition next door. They're very sensitive to trying to represent rather than misrepresent.
I think all of the subjects that we pick, choose to work with, there's aspects of the work that we
really admire,
and I think are actually kind of influential on our thinking. Then there's aspects to the work that we struggle with, that raises issues for us, that we really can't reconcile with our love for the work. And so I think we have a really profoundly ambivalent relationship to the subject, which is part, just sort of almost fan enthusiasm and part, sort of critically entangled, I guess. And that's what keeps it really interesting and alive for us, the working on these projects, and interesting. So in some ways, some of the projects are about the subject, but they're also about other subjects that aren't necessarily in the work.
And I think that's what's an interesting, for me personally, but I think for a lot of people, it's an interesting thing that comes out of it, is the meta sort of situation. Of course, it's an amazing opportunity to even see a Katie Nolan show approximately, but then there's something about the strategy in general, which is, this layer that is the problematic layer that, allows the knee-jerk for parody or the shock and sacrilege would probably be an appropriate word that generally people would tend to feel. And I guess I have a kind of range of things I wanted to touch on with that, but I guess I first wanted to say, what is that kind of say about the response, this idea of responsibility of the institution, because you did touch on this issue of the desire, but the word responsibility really echoes in this case, because it's somehow, I think there's a belief that institutions are there to be caretakers for these personalities,
right.
and in this case you've
In some cases I think we saw, Katie Nolan's a good example of this. Our gallery in Harlem was about 10 blocks from Columbia University, which is also in Harlem, and has a very, very strong master's program in fine arts. We were hearing from faculty there that were close to a lot of younger, a generation of artists that had come out of the Columbia program around 2000 were highly influenced by Katie Nolan's work. You'd see it absolutely in their work, people like Banks Violet and other people. Then, by the time we did this show, by 2006, we were hearing from faculty there that the incoming class had no idea who Katie Nolan was, because there was no visibility for her work at all. And people were only seeing these vestiges of her work and the work of a younger generation without having any understanding of the context. So we almost saw this awareness closing, this gap closing. And to some degree, this was a desire to kind of stick a wedge in that door and pry it back open again. To maintain this historical awareness of
right.
her
But I mean, in terms of institutions and people, you know, we had an artist friend of ours say, you know, I think the thing that really drives people crazy about Triple Candy is that, you know, you're self-regulated. You know, you don't have, we had a very small board, so we didn't have to please anybody. Mm. You know, we just, which is a big part of it, because when you have those limitations on you, then you make different decisions. Mm-hmm. And so we were really lucky in that way. And I think that gave us the freedom. Well, we knew we had that freedom. And so then once we realized that we could take it, instead of just blindly kind of following the way that people do exhibitions in the art world, mm-hmm. It was really liberating. And
But trying to bring it back to responsibility, yeah. Trying to do it with a certain degree of responsibility, but maybe not responsibility to the artist, which is typically the responsibility
right.
that a
right.
nonprofit alternative space is expected to have and mm-hmm. expected to show it to an even higher degree than a commercial space might,
right.
Which is in it for pure profit. We decided that wasn't the audience we wanted the primary responsibility to. We wanted it to another audience.
And so I guess the kind of other side of this is to really unpack the, in a way, the legacy of the exhibition copy. And that it is a practice we're ultimately familiar with, but it's done with complicit with the artist's intention or with the artist themselves or the foundation. And so we are, in a lot of ways, used to experiencing simulations of these situations. And I just kind of, I personally remember, I had worked on an exhibition at the Guggenheim in Las Vegas. It was a pop art show called American Pop Icons. And I remember going to this exhibition and people saying, are these the real thing? You know, and it's Vegas, so of course, you know, why not ask that question? Because why bother having the real thing in Vegas? Mm-hmm. It's all kind of simulacra. And it brings a very curious question about the experience it mediates because of its distance from the authentic object. And I guess how has that sort of played a part in...
I think part because we don't have to use the actual object and we've decided to be critical. I mean, a big part of this, too, is that, you know, most museums and galleries, when they show an artist's work, it's all, you know, they're pumping up this artist. It's all very positive. And that's just the way it's been. You know, you don't show an artist in your gallery or your museum if you don't like their work, or at least if you're not going to promote them.
Or if you have
them.
Mixed feelings, or if you...
Right. So... Because of this, we were able, by stepping back like that, we were able to be critical, which opened up all these different ways of viewing his work and her work, which I think opened up, I don't know, new questions about what they were doing, what they're doing now, why they are the way they are, mm-hmm. why are they influential.
I think the other thing, too, that I think responds to that is that, in some ways, our own position, because we're not... we don't have immediate access to these objects, you know. We don't have the power or the access to a lot of collectors that own these objects, to the institutions to get in the back storage room, etc. Mm. We sit in this space, and our relationship to these objects and to these histories is in this mediated space. That's the space that we're living in mm-hmm. as curators. And so, in some ways, this is just further reflecting that position.
Mm-hmm.
And not trying to overcome it by attaining a certain degree of access that, in general, most people don't have.
But here's a crap question: is it art? I mean, there's clearly something that happens, a disconnect of, you know, because we are, you know, allowing a lot of other businesses and industries play with the copy and the simulation in various ways. This business is so preoccupied with being in the presence of, you know, the residue of the artist's touch and all of these aspects that whatever it is, we fetishize about original objects. And so I'm wondering, like...
We call it an art experience.
Nice.
You know. So you're learning something, you're seeing something,
But it's not. But the objects aren't art, obviously.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's an experience about art.
Yeah.
Why obviously? Why can't you sell that piece then?
Well, that's...
We choose not to. I mean, yeah. in that case,
yeah,
it might be...
this was a difficult thing because...
That, there was immediate legal issues that we would... But I think, you know, I think we're coming at it. Our motivations were more historical and educational, first and foremost. So it wasn't... the whole reason for us doing the gallery, in part in the context that we're doing the gallery in, where a lot of walk-in traffic we would get, some walk-in traffic we would get would be people that are very, very comfortable with contemporary art and many people that aren't. And so we did... very much feel like a certain, I think first and foremost, we would align more with an educational position than we would with a artistic or position. So we've always had day jobs and to support our personal lives, and then the gallery has always been run as its own thing so that we can maintain. It's not something that we've entertained. We struggled with it a little bit when an opportunity like that has come up on a couple of occasions.
There's an artist named Sturtevant.
Yes,
yes.
Right.
Lichtenstein at Warhol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes.
She's the original appropriation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
She sells for major bucks.
Yeah.
She has a different philosophy, but with this show in particular, all the works were destroyed afterwards. Because, I mean, we do that with a lot of our work, but in particular this show, because if something ended up somehow, I mean, you know, you could tell it's not a Kitty Nolan, but some of these pieces, you know, came kind of close, and then you could probably slide it in somewhere. So every, you know, and that's where, like, the suing issue would come in, or somehow down the line that would come back to.
But almost all of our shows we've destroyed afterwards, and we'll keep the materials and recycle them and make a new show with them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important, I mean... They're ephemeral. They're meant to sort of exist for the moment, and we don't want to deal with storage issues. And
it's like a three-dimensional PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah.
Something like or, that.
Yeah.
I'm going to... We need to get to Sky Jones, because there was so much to talk about, but I want to just, if we could briefly touch on this project, which never happened. This was your only... properly canceled, controversial exhibition, which was a kind of reinterpretation of the history of Arte Povera, and it was meant to be in Turin, the site where Arte Povera originated, and through the curator Germano Chalant, he made a variety of exhibitions that created ultimately this movement in it that identified certain tendencies in sculpture, particularly in Italy, that were dealing with low materials. Again, very consistent with, in a way, the Hammonds and the Noland. And this was an exhibition that was, stop me if I'm wrong, it was commissioned by the art fair Artissima, which, you know, has a very curatorial leaning program to it and is very much interested in pushing the kind of dialogue to a degree that that they're involved in, maybe not so specifically as their practice, but it is a very curatorial fair, and I always felt that the curator at the time or the director Francesco Manacorda had a pretty liberal sensibility, and yet everything sort of fell apart with this. I wonder if we could sort of, you know, if you want to introduce the show a bit, and then maybe we can just talk about what went wrong.
Well, go ahead.
We proposed to him because it's the show. He invited us to do a show with no subject, you know. And we said, well, okay, you're in Turin. We have to do it on Arte Povera. It's work that's really, you know, resonates with us materially. And it's also a great subject for an art historian because the movement has been defined in so many different ways over time. That it almost, its definition has become so vague and fuzzy around the edges that it's sort of a wonderful subject. And there's so many contradictions within the way that it was defined by Chalant.
Mm-hmm. And by the artists themselves.
And the artist relationships.
Critics, other critics.
So what we wanted to do, Chalant at the same time was doing a huge show in 7 different cities around Italy called Arte Povera International, which was, you know, really, you know, he started the movement in the late 60s. He'd done a series of shows. It was really, again, like another massive attempt to really sort of keep it in the historic consciousness as, you know, one of the great sort of cultural legacies of Italy. And we thought it was an important, and because he's the only, he's defined it. We thought it was a really great opportunity to try to surface all this scholarship that's come about in the last 10 years that's really wrestled with, you know, the definition of Arte Povera and whether it really even existed as a movement.
Or whether it's even relevant even or, if that it's a valid or that movement. Important.
Yeah. Or yeah. Even debates about its significance as a movement. We thought it'd be interesting to sort of do a counter exhibition to start to generate some dialogue so it wasn't just somebody's...
Which questioned the validity of the
which
movement.
Questioned the validity of the movement.
Right.
And so he was okay with that, the Francesco Bandicorta. He was very nervous about it, but we kept talking about this the productive tension that it creates, and you know that it, you know, he was I think okay with the idea that if there was a constructive dialogue that came out of it, it could be really important dialogue for Italy to have. And but as I think it got very close, about 2 weeks before the show was to open, as we kept sending him examples of what we were doing, and he kept seeing it, how it was going to manifest itself, he just kept getting more and more and more nervous about it. And we can talk about why in a second. But one of the things he decided to do, we had an agreement that he wasn't going to talk to any of the people involved with Arte Povera before it opened, so that there would be no rumor mill in advance of it, so that the people would come to see it, they could judge it on its own terms. 2 weeks beforehand, he started getting really nervous because the fair had very important relationships with commercial galleries that represented the artists, with Chalant himself. He had personal relationships with Chalant, with people that were sort of the keepers of the flame. And so he decided to send a trial balloon and see what some of them thought to try to get a read on what the reaction would be beforehand. And
what did you say, a trial balloon?
Yeah, send up like, yeah.
Okay.
Is that a bet? The wrong...
No, I never heard the...
So he contacted Beatrice Meritz, who's the daughter of 2 very prominent Arte Povera artists, and she basically said, "That's ridiculous. You can't do it. You know, just like done. Don't do it. You're gonna shoot. You're gonna kill the fair. It's gonna be this horrible experience." So he got really nervous, and I'm not sure that was the only thing that influenced him. I think it was his own reaction, maybe to the work. But
yeah, I mean, it was an interesting process because. We did have 1 Skype, but for the most part, it was all email. And there was a crescendo of nervousness that started developing over the course of a month. And we started reacting back because at one point he was making these really sweeping, crazy statements like that this was going to take down the art.
It was going to... It could negatively impact... funding for contemporary art in Italy, in the entire country of Italy.
I mean, he was saying, you know,
that's how nervous he was. He was saying the stakes were that great, which to us seemed totally absurd to us. And God, if you know, like a show could even generate that level,
amazing, do it.
Yeah,
we weren't looking for that. We were just looking for some constructive dialogue. But,
so you know, and we started responding like, "Oh, come on, you know, we were." Kind of getting a little snarky back with him, but just because it just seems so ridiculous. I mean, it would be, you know, the political arena in Turin, then it would be the artists who are still alive, the artists who were still alive, you know, hurting them. Then the audience who wouldn't understand it, who would think that we were making fun of them. And then the artists who did understand it, but, you know, there was, you know, the money investment in the works that people had owned, and what is that going to do to the value of these works if somebody even remotely criticizes, you know, the movement that they've been trying to maintain. So we were kind of watching this, like, happen, you know, from a distance, and, you know, finally it just imploded. It wasn't angry. It was just this, you know, we could just sense that he was talking to people, and like Aaron was saying today too, like the Sky Jones show. You know, it seems like on the surface, to do a show without the permission of the artist necessarily, and what does that mean? Is that going to create problems? You know, but when you see it or you experience it, it just doesn't have that same danger. But I think he was just too influenced by way too many things.
And I think the other thing, too, is the show, there was tons of reading and tons of text in the show that really sort of laid out the argument, laid out Chalant's argument, laid out other historians' counter-arguments. And it was sort of very heavily researched. But because nobody wants to go look at an art show that's just a bunch of text, we had created surrogates and props, like we did with the other shows, that represented the works in question. And we did it with a certain playful flair. I mean, the total show might be, there was certainly satire woven through the show. I think he was really nervous that it was just straight parody. He hadn't read all the text yet when he decided to cancel it, which would have really countered any of that.
Maybe that's a good opportunity to go into Sky Jones. We probably should maybe give about 15 or 20 minutes, depending on your patience, but it's a really... we could have spent this whole time just talking about this show, so we'll figure out a way to put it all together here. I guess I would start off by saying we initiated a dialogue in around July. They contacted me to see about the possibility of making an exhibition here, and I said absolutely, because of my personal professional sort of influence that they've had on my work, and my biggest problem with it was the fact that I felt that their work is kind of intrinsically, understood within the art world, within the art context, because it plays with so many of these parameters and lenses that lend it the experience that is this kind of multi-layered thing. So to do something here, I was very interested in how it could work here in Salt Lake City, how we could make something here that would resonate in the local kind of cultural situation, and they came back at me with several proposals. It was really exciting to get these like four or five options, and we kind of managed to narrow it down almost in a kind of circuitous way to what you'll see next door. I wonder if we could just talk about how it arrived to Sky Jones, because many people don't know about the kind of original group that you were researching that led to Sky Jones. So, and then maybe we can really delve into Sky Jones.
Well, we started out, our research, as most research is, was sort of, meandering and sort of this wonderful sort of exploration. And started out looking at the work of an artist, Paul McCarthy, who lives in L.A. but went to the University of Utah. Started this performance troupe called, series of happenings called the Upriver School. And it's very early in his career, and it's not really well known. And so we thought that'd be really exciting to look into what that was. Through that, and looking at the people and cast of characters and people involved that were all students there, we found out about this Salt Lake Mime Troupe, neither of us knew anything about. So we started exploring that, and that was fascinating and great. And we were in touch with some of the people that were part of the troupe. And then
Troupe lasted for 30 years or something. No, it was like a really long time, but it's since not really present in people's.
And in the process of doing that, we stumbled across one of the people that was part of that was friends with Paul McCarthy. And some of the people that ended up spinning off and becoming the mime troupe was this man named Michael Whipple. And we were both reaching out and emailing everybody to try to get as much information about Upriver School or the mime troupe. And it kept coming back, this name Michael Whipple kept coming back. Oh, you need to talk to Mike Whipple. He was really instrumental in this social circle at this time. Really interesting guy. I went to L.A. I think he's back. I'm not sure where he is these days. Tried to find him out. So we started doing, a lot of online research and started finding out information about this artist named Michael Whipple, and then found references to this artist named Sky Jones, a.k.a. Michael Whipple, and then this artist, Siren Bliss, a.k.a. Sky Jones, a.k.a. Michael Whipple. And then all these, once we started to get into this story, it became this total rabbit hole that just was really fascinating. This artist who... was also sort of this mysterious figure that was really hard to kind of pin down who he is, exactly what he did, there is quite actually a lot of, thanks to him, a lot of information about his chronology and his history on the web, and that's where we were finding a lot of information. But we just became really fascinated with his persona, the way he decided to structure his life, the type of art world that he wanted to associate with, the type of art world he created for himself, his commitment to advancing his own technique as a painter, and his reverence for the act of painting and sculpture and the history of painting and sculpture.
And yet he's virtually unknown.
And yet
this is the crazy thing.
Within an art world that we participate in and are aware of, he's not well known.
This is an installation view of Next Door. So this is the exhibition we're opening tonight.
So we said to Aaron, we said, wow, we found this artist that's born in Salt Lake City, his family's there. He's just really fascinating to us.
A big plumbing company.
Right.
Yes, exactly. And we just wanted to know more. It would be okay if we kind of, dive into this, the mythology of this artist, and just really do a show about it. Aaron was like, yeah, I'm game. Let's go ahead. Keep going.
I mean, it was weird because if you do your research, you find a lot of kind of alleyways, dead ends, and sort of labyrinths that will really suck you in. And I remember we could talk about Bankers Art Museum, my first time on the Bankers Art Museum website, seeing this work and thinking, well, that's, looks like art. And some of it even really looked like contemporary art in a way that I was like, okay, that could really make sense. I mean, but what I didn't detect was the hook, which is the trap door of this world that he really has fabricated. I didn't know what I was looking at actually, in terms of this really well constructed universe, which is Sky Jones, which is Michael Whipple, which is Bankers Art Museum, and that moment really kind of, of course it was at your descriptions, and I just wondered, this subject is different from all these other ones we've talked about for so many reasons in a way. I mean, there is the relationship of the material sensibility to a degree in the sculptures you see there in the foreground, but he's not a known artist. He's a very obscure artist. The other artists you've done this practice or this approach with have been very known artists. And I wondered how this is different for you guys in terms of what it's led to and your own approach and as a kind of output, what this exhibition is and how it changes from previous iterations of this.
I mean, I'll say that. Just what is the same, and there are a lot of things that are different, but what is the same is, and what we were talking about with the staff earlier, is that it's the story.
Yeah.
And the story of Hammonds and Nolan were both, Catalan, they were all very interesting to us because that's what we're doing in these shows. We're telling a story about somebody's work, about their life.
And the choices they make in terms of their relationship to an art world
and anecdotes about, I mean, Catalan was full of anecdotes about his life.
Mm-hmm.
And same here. So that's the similar part, but then how it's different, and Peter, maybe you could talk about that.
Well, I think, I think we came at this through the story, not aware of the art first, and then becoming aware of the mythology that surrounded it. Here we sort of entered it through the mythology, and then arrived more at the level of the object. I think one of the things that's really fascinating about the way he thinks about his work is he's a very self-described manifestor. He's somebody who is very, very productive and makes a lot of work and feels that you have to make a lot of work to become, to produce quality. Quantity first, then quality. You arrive at quality. So, if one takes what he says at face value, he says that he's made 80,000 works in his lifetime, which is an incredible amount of work, enormous. In a given 4-year period, he made 9,000 drawings. And there's evidence of high productivity that we can find. It's really hard to know if anybody could produce that much work. And so there are these statements like that that are sort of intriguing. There's the construction of this parallel sort of art world that he's created through this thing called the Banker Art Museum, which is this museum to himself and to his artwork. And it's sort of his, it's his studio, it's itinerant, so when he moves around the country, he sets up a studio and calls it the Banker's Art Museum and makes work there. But
it's more in depth than that. I mean, the Banker's Art Museum is an infrastructure. It's if you go on the website, you are, it looks like a late 90s museum website, but there's an infrastructure there. It's run by people.
Right. Yes, and they, you can get your artwork, your Sky Jones or Siren Bliss artwork authenticated through the museum. They at times they've run the BAM Drawing Club. They've done a number of activities.
There's employees.
There's employees in the museum, and this is sort of part of what makes this is. There's a man named Rich S. Dickens. There's a man involved in the museum named Joseph Banker. There's a man involved in the museum named Art Carter. And these words are all sort of funny names. They're plays. Like Art Carter is an art handler. He's the art handler curator at the museum. Rich S. Dickens is the wealthy patron, who's rich as the Dickens. Joseph Banker is the, you know, the director of the museum. These are all roles that are all played by Sky Jones. They, none of these people exist except as alter egos for Sky Jones. So you start to wonder, what is the artistic product here? Is it at the level of the individual painting, or is this whole career this sort of vast performative enterprise? And you realize that it's the whole career is this vast performative enterprise, that we're, objects that clearly function as discrete art objects play a role exist within the system, but they too are almost props within this larger performance.
Well, and I think, and again, like, what's different from like Hammond's and Nolan and Catalan is that that's all real, like palpable information, and you don't necessarily dispute it or distrust
the information you have on Hammond's and Nolan.
Right, and with this artist, you know, you don't know what to believe. You do not know what's truth or what's fiction, and I think that kind of plays around with what we do in general because people don't necessarily trust whether or not what we're doing is truth or fiction either, and so maybe it's like coming closer in a way
to our own practice in a way. So,
well, you said a really nice thing before when we were doing a little gallery walkthrough. You know that you get in the beginning, you got really hung up on the fact or fiction of it, and it was only when you let that go that it suddenly allows itself to just kind of, you know, be something quite special. And I think that's what's for me really also quite interesting is that this. It's in, on the one hand, it's your approach to the delivery of the information, the structure that's put in place there through the didactic labels, combined with this story that I think the interesting situation would be to gauge viewer experience, because I think what will happen ultimately is you'll have somebody who's kind of driving headfirst into it and it, before it's too late to back up and say, hey, what the hell's going on here, you know? Is this any of this real? Is this a 3D PowerPoint presentation? Is this artist real? Is any of this information real? And I think that's what leaves me kind of uncomfortably satisfied with the whole thing in that regard. Because I do think there's an incredible experience at work here, which is much like going on the Banker's Art Museum website. You, if you're not paying attention, you're in the web. And I think you guys have created that in a really accurate way somehow. And I guess I wanted to, it kind of comes back again to this issue of the exhibition copy, but also the experience that you aim to produce in this situation.
And we want it to be very accessible so that the barriers to entering into the narrative, so that you can get sucked into the story, are low.
Mm-hmm.
We want that to be in terms of the types of objects that are on view, the way the labels are written, the type of language we're using. in the labels. But just to be clear, too, so in this picture, as you'll see it upstairs, the objects in the room are all things that help us. They're almost like narrative aids. They help us tell the story as we understand it of this fascinating artist. So they're either objects that we've remade that are approximations of his drawings that are maybe not the same scale, but they're copied as faithfully as possible, or they're sculptures that are done sort of in the spirit of the work but aren't necessarily that faithful, but help, but give you something to look at and help us tell a story in a wall label about a project that he did. Or, you know, their case.
Yeah, well, this is we haven't really talked about it, but his whole, the way that he functions in the world is by bartering. How he pays rent, buys food, he exchanges his work for other objects. And at times he has, you know, he's bartered. He became a sock salesman, pantyhose, real estate, cars. So we have, like, little representations of the things.
Phone cards, like, you know, he'll trade large quantities of artwork for real estate deed or for corporate stock or for...
allegedly.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Going at his... Artist? Always have to go at his word, so...
When you look at the work, is it one artist or three artists?
It's multiple artists. Hmm? Multiple artists, clearly. There's a lot of different
styles.
Do you see a multiple personality?
Well, we don't know him, so we don't know. I mean, you know,
yeah.
The performance certainly is. The performance of.
Josie, who's a volunteer here, said that he has a son named Shri, who...
Which people here, I think, know. Some people here...
Somebody said that, she said that when she's seen his work, it looks exactly like some of the drawings that we have up. Uh-huh. Which has... I've always kind of had this idea that his sons and maybe his brothers, he has a big family, that the family is kind of involved in the whole production of this company. I don't know that. That's just my belief because the styles are so different.
Either that or he's just very nimbly
right.
alternating from, you know, highly meticulously rendered, technically very proficient, figurative paintings to spin paintings that are, you know, very, very loose and
this is
delicate little drawings to big, you know, chirpy, like, simplistic drawings.
I wonder, to just kind of get close to the end, mm-hmm. and maybe people have some questions. Okay. There's a moment that that Sky Jones has a pretty strong breach with reality, where the fiction has to start becoming fact with the SEC deposition. And I think that's really somehow where this gets even more interesting as we try to start to make tangible what is real and what's not, and it just becomes all the more slippery. I wonder if, you know, could you touch on what that had to offer?
A really wonderful piece of research for us was he was interviewed by lawyers representing the Security Exchange Commission in 97 and 2001. The SEC was suing two corporations that had large holdings of Sky Jones artwork that they had on the books at very, very high valuations. And these companies were selling stocks in the corporations based on these corporate values that were pumped up by these, or what the SEC thought were pumped up values.
Values that came from Sky himself.
That he appraised the work himself. So the SEC was questioning him about, you know, are these accurate? What methods do you use to appraise your work? Are there comparables? Are they independently appraised? They were asking all these questions. But they were really trying to understand his practice. And they got into all the questions about, like, the multiple identities, what is the Bankers Art Museum, what's its relationship to your practice and the appraisal process. And it's a really fascinating document because Sky speaks, in great detail about lots of business transactions, about bartering, about the choices he's made regarding his lifestyle. It's really fascinating. And it is this moment where the surface of the Bankers Art Museum, with all its sort of, you know, with its structure as an organization that's that's its own performance.
But he's like also smart enough to know that if he says the wrong thing, he's going to be in trouble. So when he starts to feel that he's going down that line, he backtracks, and he'll blame the attorneys, you know,
for pushing him in there.
For pushing him, and he'll start to then kind of talk nonsense or try to take over. He'll take over the deposition himself and start to ask them questions. So
or
I think
he'll
by
question,
the end,
or he'll question in really great, wonderful, fascinating ways.
Yeah.
Sort of their own assumptions about
right.
about him, about the art world, about.
And I think in the end, they
the
just
choices he's made.
They just don't even know what to do. So it just basically, you know.
They let it go, or
yeah.
How does it end?
Thank you very much for your time. I'm not sure. I mean, we don't. There was twice, and then the SEC exonerated. You know, like at that point, we can't find any follow up to that where he got. You know, it was in trouble for any of the activity. But so I think they just say, yeah.
Is Mr. Whipple here in the audience by chance? maybe that's a good opportunity to open it up to any questions anyone might have.
I don't have a question, but I almost see him as a performance artist.
Mm-hmm.
And his performance is living a life of a very unusual artist and in his story. Because that, to me, is, I mean, it's art, it's an experience, but the story is what makes it, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
Yes, Mr. David.
One of the things that I noticed, that I was aware of outside of this show, is the common tie of having either like raw materials or low materials or even found objects. And is that something that is like an important criterion in the selection of the artist, or does that just kind of happen with these more elusive art figures?
Well, you know, Rizzo is very high end. But yeah, I think we're drawn to that.
Okay.
I mean, I think they're always, you know.
We're also aware of our own limitations in terms
yeah.
of what we can
right.
do, so. That plays a factor, I think, and we're not going to put, you know, yeah.
Jeff Koons level production.
Yeah.
For the sake of a show that then would get discarded, probably.
Is another component of it to keep that distance kind of obvious as well? Like if you're trying to make a, you know, surrogate or represent something but not have it mistaken as
yeah.
a copy?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
And not wanting things to be too precious, too. And same with the artist, because, you know, like we were saying, if we met, you know, Sky, if he came tonight, it'd be great to meet him, but we wouldn't have wanted to meet him before
while
the show
the
opened. Because even that distance is really important. Because, you know, you can be so influenced.
We're trying to work with the information that a general interested public would have access to.
Keep them steep.
Just so that's, you know, we're representing that and what's available to those that can only get their information through public channels, you know, the internet or whatever we have, not because, you know, we know family members or whatever and have inside.
There's not a book on him, is there? Is it all through?
He's actually written a number
himself.
Of books.
He's written books
yeah.
himself?
Yeah.
Under different names?
There's a retrospective book that he did under Siren Bliss.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a book. It started as Michael Whipple, but actually it was signed Sky Jones, called The Artist's Bible, which is, it's like really pedagogical. It's really about sort of words of wisdom, you know, from somebody who's been spending a lot of time thinking about
how to paint.
And,
can you get them? I'm a book.
They're available on the Bankers Art Museum website. The PDFs. We went into Sanders today, and I was looking to see if these things exist in physical form anywhere. I have no idea if they did or do, but you can get them online, which is great.
Great.
Well, thanks so much, everyone, for coming. Thank you, Peter and Shelley.
Much.
Thank you, Aaron.
Yeah, absolutely.
If any of you guys know him and are sticking around, sticking around. We'd love to hear if anything we said squared at all with your own reality.
I know where Sri is.
Yeah?
Do you?
Sri is, yeah.
Oh, Sri is, right.
Oh, you're kidding. Yeah. Mwah, that was lovely. Sorry it took so long.
No, it's
really. I'm surprised you didn't show up.